The investigation continues into Sunday's kayak accident on Mendenhall Lake that claimed the life of a cruise ship passenger from Texas. 62-year-old Michael Ray Fullerton of Georgetown, Texas, was among four family members who were paddling on the lake. Tongass National Forest Supervisor Forrest Cole says Fullerton became fatigued and was unable to paddle.
The group tied their kayaks together, and it's still unclear to us at this point how the kayaks overturned. I have been told that two were out of the water and one was in the water. I've been told it was in the water for approximately 30 minutes. They had flagged down a canoeist who came to rescue them. They were all taken to the beach.
Capital City Fire and Rescue Chief Rich Etheridge said the kayakers were arriving on shore when they got there about 5:30. They were responding to a call about people in the water. Etheridge said the man who reportedly had been in the water for 30 minutes, now known to be Fullerton, was not breathing. Etheridge said the medical team initiated CPR and he was transported to Bartlett Regional Hospital, where he was pronounced deceased.
The other remaining people were just treated for mild hypothermia, transported to the hospital, and just kind of everybody met up at the hospital where the family was treated and released.
The names of the other family members have not been made available yet. The family was on the Rhapsody of the Seas, a Royal Caribbean ship. They were not on a guided trip, but had rented tandem kayaks and safety gear from Alaska Boat and Kayak Center in Aka Bay at about 3 o'clock. Owner Sean Jane says they were all given a safety briefing.
They get questioned about how much paddle experience they've had, and then they get a thorough safety briefing that talks about self-rescue, using the bilge pump, paddle float, wearing the PFD and spray skirt, and how to work together and paddle as a group.
Jane says the group also had information about paddling on Mendenhall Lake, staying away from icebergs and the glacier, and places along the glacier where boaters should stay at least 200 yards away from the face.
And we've got it on a laminated map, so people are able to see that map and see some of the hazards around the area. So we're trying to outfit them with as much knowledge and safety tools as possible.
Jane says tandem kayaks are stable boats and generally hard to tip over. Forest Service Supervisor Forrest Cole says a Forest Service special agent and law enforcement officer are still conducting interviews on the accident. Juneau police are recommending that three Juneau teenagers be charged in connection with throwing rocks Sunday at vehicles in the valley, injuring at least one person. Police say they received several calls about rocks being thrown in the area of Stephen Richards Drive and Mendenhall Loop Road. When they investigated, police found two juvenile boys and an 18-year-old hiding in the bushes, and one had rocks in his hands. Police questioned the boys and released them to their parents. Then they learned a 6-year-old boy had been cut by flying debris when a rock smashed through the rear window of the vehicle in which he was riding. His mother stopped the vehicle and called 911. The boy was taken to the hospital by ambulance, where he was treated for a severe laceration to his cheek. Police say the boys who were allegedly throwing rocks may be charged with assault, criminal mischief, false information to law enforcement, and minor consuming. A defense attorney applying for post-conviction relief under a relatively new Alaska law hopes other suspects will surface, casting doubt on his client's implication in a double homicide in Juneau 30 years ago. Newton Lambert was just 21 years old when he was convicted for the murder of Ann Vinolkin in her South Franklin Street apartment in April of 1982. She was found, along with her husband James, at least 9 days after they were both sexually assaulted and stabbed to death. Lambert was acquitted in James Vinolkin's murder. Co-defendant Emmanuel Tallis was acquitted of both murder charges during a subsequent trial. During a hearing Friday, Lambert's attorney Jude Pate argued that Alaska's new post-conviction DNA testing statute is different than an earlier version of the proposed law that had a higher burden or standard to show conclusive proof.
So it's our position that the only the burden for us is a reasonable probability that Mr. Lambert did not commit the offense.
Pate hopes to prove that DNA left at the scene in the form of blood on James Bedonkin's sweatshirt and semen on his pants will indicate suspects other than Lambert and possibly Tullis. If a fifth or sixth person is identified as being in the Bedonkin apartment, then according to Pate, someone else besides Lambert may have participated in the crime. It also points to the testimony of a hair sample from discredited FBI agent Michael Malone that the prosecution relied on at trial. particularly during closing arguments.
The FBI did a review of many of Agent Malone's cases, and he was a serial liar and put many people away that shouldn't have been. And the FBI found that his testimony that there was only a 1 in 5,000 chance that this hair wasn't Mr. Lambert's was not correct. It wasn't supported.
Assistant District Attorney Amy Williams says Pate's interpretation of the new post-conviction DNA testing statute to include the lower reasonable probability standard is just wrong.
Every inmate that we work with could find some way to say, well, what's his face who testified against me as a jerk and he hated me all along and my attorney didn't cross-examine him thoroughly and that scientist person is a hack and my attorney didn't cross-examine him thoroughly and there's a reasonable probability that I didn't commit this offense, so I should get DNA testing. That's basically what Mr. Lambert is asking for. If that were the standard, almost every person that we've convicted where any biological sample was collected at all would be allowed to have DNA testing. We wouldn't need the statute. It could be de facto.
She also points to the totality of the evidence presented at trial nearly 30 years ago, including Lambert blacking out and waking up in the Bonalcan bathtub and no innocence theory presented at trial. In addition, Lambert was convicted for Ann Bonalcan's murder, not James' murder. Pate and Williams made their arguments before Ketchikan Superior Court Judge Michael Carey on Friday. Much of the long, nearly four-hour evidentiary hearing centered on discussion and critique of the chain of custody of evidence samples from the Lambert and Tullis cases. The shirt and pants watches were stored in a freezer in a California laboratory, which survived undisturbed and intact when it was transported to a new lab. But three slides of microscopic evidence from an unrelated case apparently were mixed in with three slides from the Lambert and Tullis cases. Judge Carey may issue an opinion sometime next month. One of the witnesses who was not able to testify Friday, a DNA technical manager of the state crime lab, will listen back to the other testimony and offer her own comments on chain of custody procedures. The price of Brent crude oil this morning is $104.67 a barrel. West Texas Intermediate is at $88.63 a barrel. Gold is down $5 in New York spot market trading, currently at $1,583.40 an ounce. Lead is also down, currently 85 cents a pound. The Juneau Assembly last night appropriated nearly $23.5 million for runway safety area improvements at the Juneau International Airport. Most of the funding will be provided by a $17 million grant from the Federal Aviation Administration. The Alaska Department of Transportation and the city-owned airport will split the rest. But airport manager Jeannie Johnson says the city's contribution will be in the form of fill material provided to the FAA for the project, which the airport has already on hand.
The fill is the fill that came out of the bottom of the float pond, and FAA is paying us for that. So really, it's an in-kind match. So we aren't buying any more material. The material's already been removed from the float pond, actually, and placed. It's just the method of how FAA has to pay us for it.
The airport had the float pond dredged early in the runway safety area improvement project, which has been ongoing since at least 2009. This new phase is for installation of FAA facilities. The assembly last night also awarded SEACON a $12.3 million contract for another phase of the project. SEACON will relocate the thresholds for two runways and move two taxiways. And funding for that work is also largely being funded or provided by the FAA.